Crystal Da Costa asks, "What is the boogeyman?" And she reminds us that 8-year-old Tommy Doyle poses this question to his babysitter Laurie Strode in the movie Halloween. He means it to be casual by slipping it into a discussion about his comics, but he has a genuine need to know. He wants to be prepared in case he bumps into it, and this is perhaps something we can all relate to regardless of where we live or how old we are. Tommy Doyle never received an answer from Laurie. He's dismissed and reassured that there is nothing to worry about. But what is the boogeyman? For Tommy, the boogeyman was Michael Myers, also aptly known as the Shape, for the boogeyman has no specific form. It can become whatever it needs to be most effective in its objective of scaring you straight. The boogeyman may very well be universal. Some variation is found in almost every culture. It goes by many names: Jumbie, Krampus, Baba Yaga. However named, its purpose is to steal and or punish children. We all meet it early in our lives, whether by our own imagining or because it is invoked to teach a lesson. For example, if you don't eat your vegetables, the X will come for you. And that's the key. The boogeyman is there to ensure that we follow the rules, and it gets its power from the persistence of folklore. This oral exchange educates on and reinforces the expectations for members of the community. Folk tales are local to the people who tell them and reveal much about their perceptions of the world around them. They grow and change in their tellings and are adapted for the time in which they are told. The most widely known collection of such tales come from Brothers Grimm. The Grimm characters were teaching tools. They were designed to maintain the social order, and ultimately, it is only by understanding our missteps and accepting ownership for them that we can banish the boogeyman. That from the article, "What is the Boogeyman?" by Crystal Da Costa in Scientific American in October 2016. You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list, checking it twice. Gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. Certainly the answer to Da Costa's question can't be Santa Claus. But he does have what some might call an alter ego in a figure known as the Krampus. Just cited by Da Costa in her essay, modern questing is describing the Krampus as a demon henchman who, according to centuries-old Austrian folklore, accompanies St. Nicholas on the eve of St. Nicholas Day. Kindly old St. Nick hands out presents to the good children, while Krampus torments the naughty ones with birch rods and rusty chains and threats of abduction. Others remind us that the Krampus has been creeping up here in the United States of late, and as recently as 2 weekends ago, crowds gathered in Philadelphia for what is called a Krampus Run. Mark Stavish is intrigued by folk customs of all kinds and the cross-pollination between and among cultures and eras. He is the author of over a dozen books. He's appeared on the History Channel and A&E as an expert on Western spiritual traditions and comparative religions, and he's director of studies for the Institute for Hermetic Studies. Mark Stavish stopped in at the WVIA studios to talk with us about the modern comeback of the Krampus.
My encounter with Krampus was fairly recent when folks started talking to me about it. I said, well, what is this? I said, this is wonderful. It's a survival of this pre-Christian, Germanic, mostly in the Alpine region, into the Slavic territories, into Slovenia and Croatia, of these pre-Christian beliefs that are absorbed into the Christmas season. And why it's important to us is it survives in another form in Pennsylvania. among the Pennsylvania Germans. So you have two things of interest. One is the Pennsylvania connection, and two, the Krampus revival.
Can you have a Krampus without a St. Nicholas or Santa Claus figure? Do they go hand in hand?
Well, they do. We have St. Nicholas, who is famous for his gift-giving, among other things, appear on the scene around the 11th century. And then sometime around the 16th century, he's hooked up with this cloven-footed, devil-like figure with horns and furs and birch branches and a basket and chains and bells and all this wonderful stuff. And we'll get into what that means. Now, they're hooked up together. And basically, they have this is a buddy road show where they are good cop, bad cop, going down the road, visiting all the houses. And of course, the good children get candy and the bad children get carted off. Or they get coal or whatever the local tradition happens to be. Now, we do see later on, though, a separation where Krampus begins to appear separately. And he appears the night before St. Nicholas Day, which is December 6th. So he appears on December 5th. Because, you know, we celebrate Christmas, but really, prior to really the 20th century, it was a holiday season. There are a variety of holidays that took place across this period. So you have St. Nicholas Day on December 6th. You have the solstice, which is very important because this is Yule, on the 21st, 22nd. You have Christmas. And then you have what most people have heard of and don't know what they are, those famous 12 days of Christmas that go all the way to January 6th or Epiphany, which is Feast of the Three Kings, the wise men who visited Jesus. So it's a season. And we see Kramp, of course, I guess there's a lot of houses to visit, so they split the duties. Now, later on in Pennsylvania, when we see the survival of this Krampus-like figure, he and St. Nicholas kind of get combined. And that gives us Belschnickel.
Where does the word come from, Krampus? Do we know what the derivation of that is?
What I've come across is it means claw. So I think of cramping, or, you know, a hand cramps up or kind of claws up. What's really interesting is when you read about these things in folklore and you notice how the words change there's these subtle variations both in the meaning of a word but also in the dialects. We think of language as being very uniform now, but really our notion of language being uniform is only a result of mass media. It is really a very mid-20th century phenomenon. So when you look at something like German, Swiss German even now is terribly difficult and almost impossible to understand, I'm told, from someone who speaks High German. So all of these different dialects are actually tribal languages. We tend to forget that. And that applies to even Italy. I was talking to folks who were Italian, and they said they speak to each other in English. So these dialects form languages. They form close-knit cultures and communities. And a lot of these traditions are an extension of that or a survival of that in some fashion. So Krampus means claw. Now, what's neat about him is he is very much like what we think of as a traditional devil. And so he's covered in hair, he has his basket, he has chains and bells, he has birch branches that he, you know, whips the bad children with. And also, interestingly, and this is important, this shows a survival to earlier European beliefs, pre-Christian beliefs, his one foot is human and his other foot is cloven, which indicates he is a supernatural character. So he survives. He survives in this alpine region, which is probably no surprising when you think of the symbolism of a goat, the mountain goats.
With the bells and the change, does that remind us of something like the mummers? Is it that kind
of... There's a distinct relationship. The mummers are Celtic survival of the same beliefs. The Slavic and Germanic and Celtic are not that different. Most people don't realize it, but what we think of as the Slavic languages don't really begin to form until about the 10th century. It's very uniform up until then. And then as they move away and they move out, then dialects begin to form, and these become what we think of as the Slavic languages. So these pan-European, Central European beliefs are fairly uniform. I mean, there's exceptions to the rule because it's just that simple. You cross a river, you cross a valley. I mean, things change, but there are a lot of things in common.
Is the Krampus a force of evil?
Yes and no. We say, when he's Christianized, the devil becomes subservient to the Lord, hence the notion of the chain or the binding. Bells are interesting because it said that, you know, the demons don't like bells, sounds of bells. But at the same time, if you look at earlier pre-Christian beliefs, bells are used in the summoning of different invisible beings. You know, if you've ever heard any of the Tibetan Buddhist rituals, there's a tremendous amount of bells and horns, a lot of noise, very chaotic noise, that's used in the calling or the summoning of the forces of, you know, of enlightenment. So Krampus, you know, depends on when you're looking at him, but what he's really reminding us of, and this is important, is, you know, he's with Saint Nick. So he's reminding us that actions have consequences. And this is what we tend to forget about. What is the purpose of the holiday? What is the real meaning of the holiday? Now in the 21st century, it's easy for us to think of it as just getting more stuff. But, you know, as Christians like to remind us, you know, Christ is the reason for the season. Well, if we go beyond that, you know, the reason for the season is also, it's the end of the year. It's the darkest time of the year. If you have not prepared, you don't survive. And among the Swiss, where Krampus was celebrated, he was a force that recognized, I love this part, this could solve all of America's problems right here, bringing back Krampus. He rewarded scholastic achievements. Because why? Learning helps you plan and get ahead. And we really don't understand that if we're not living in a rural area or where you're dependent upon thinking, you know, 6 months out, 3 months out, do I have enough food? Do I have enough firewood? You know, do I have enough of everything to get through the winter? And winters can be 4 months, 5 months long. Actions have consequences. So that's in many ways what he's telling us. So is Santa, but in a nice way too. Nick, you know, he's giving us the good stuff. We've planned ahead. Here's our candy.
Help us get from the other side of the ocean to our side of the ocean now.
Oh, well, this is where we have to look at the movement of the German peoples in the 17th century to Pennsylvania, 17th and 18th century and onward. And they're settling in southeastern PA. And the folks who are coming here are primarily what are known as Pietists. And they're bringing with them a lot of traditions and beliefs that were very personally mystical. And this is important because the Krampus and Santa and all of that time, the solstice for the Germanic peoples was really their version, or Yule, as you know, some we like to call it sometimes, but solstice was their version of Halloween because it was the darkest time of the year. And this is when the invisible world, the spiritual forces, were most easily accessed into the visible world. So this is when you see the Wild Hunt, as it later gets called. I think Grimm gives it that name, the Brothers Grimm. You have, you know, Odin and the travels of the dead going across the world, across the realm. And also where you begin to see the goddesses that have a great deal to do with illumination and light. But also they can be very fierce too at this time. This is when they begin to appear. So we have to understand that the notion of a strict demarcation line between the spiritual and the material didn't exist until fairly recently. I mean, people, of course, have always had a variety of beliefs across the board. But from this European perspective, the invisible is always there. It's always right around the corner. Now, what happens? A lot of these folks come over, of course. Catholics come over, Lutherans come over, a variety of other Protestant sects come over, and they bring with them their beliefs, and they're coming from an area in southwestern Germany known as the Palatine and Rhineland area, which was known for its rich mystical traditions in the 12th century in particular, but also in the Swiss and Austrians, and of course some of the Slavic groups that were influenced by Austrian, or what we would call Austrian, culture. So they come here and they bring Krampus with them. At some point, and I don't know when this occurs, there doesn't seem to be a real demarcation line. We no longer have Krampus and Saint Nick, but we have our fellow here who was called Belsnickel. And it sometimes is said with a B, sometimes with a P, depending on, you know, P or B sound. And nickel is for Nicholas, and the bell or pell means to belt or hit. Because, of course, remember, if you were bad, you got hit by the birch, right? Or at least something like that. And he very much has the same characteristics. He's this guy, of course, he's clearly human. He dresses in fur, and he's dirty, and he's slovenly, and sometimes has a limp. And he has a basket with him. And if you're good, you get good stuff. If you're not good, then, you know, you get nothing or get coal or something. So you have the same story, but it modifies. Now, what is interesting is that both in the European experience and in the the experience here in the United States, you have really what gives us some insight into the magical worldview of the earlier period. Because in Europe, we have also the appearance of Perchta or Pecten, okay? And this is the female version. And she goes around, of course, she brings light, but if you're not good, there's punishment too. And she has her own retinue of travelers that go with her, kind of like Odin's Wild Hunt. And this is where you get these parades now. So when you go to certain places in Europe, they have these great, they call them Krampuslauf, or these running of the parades where all these folks dress up as Krampus and run through the streets, scaring children and giving them candies. And the YouTube videos look fabulous. And my wife has warned me that I am not, I am not to initiate this in anywhere anytime soon. But so you have that going on, these Krampus runs, and you have them in the United States too. And they have one down in Philadelphia. And, that's where I got the warning from. You are not going. So this does happen, and it is this kind of revival. Now, what I was saying, though, is we have not only the women, but we have these kind of not quite inversion of gender roles, but we have men who would dress up as the female Pechten, okay, and do the roles. And we have at times in the story here, where it is a kind of a wrathful woman who comes by, or can be also be very beautiful. And of course, anyone who's studied folklore or read any fairy tales immediately begins to recognize these symbols and archetypes. And of course, they bring gifts to the children.
In addition to the runs, for example, if we go down to Southeast Pennsylvania, Lancaster, or the places where we would think of as the Pennsylvania German concentrations, do they have people dressing up?
Well, what has happened is, of course, with the, I don't want to say the demise, but the near demise or extinction of Pennsylvania German culture in the late 20th century, a lot of these things went by the wayside. But what you're seeing now is a revival in a lot of these things. There's a lot of revival of interest in folks who aren't even culturally connected to it, but they see a connection to these beliefs and these ideas. And like I said, in Philadelphia, I was told it's tonight. You want to see it. You have to come down here this weekend. And they said it's quite big. And if you go on YouTube, tremendous amount of videos of activities in Europe. And it's always probably within the last few years, because even in the 20th century, there was an attempt to eradicate it. In 1923, the Austrian government tried to get rid of the celebration of Krampus. The political party that was in control, it was deeply connected to Roman Catholic ideas. Which isn't uncommon. I mean, this is not abnormal in any way. It's just if you look at the history of the area. And they tried to really stop it. And in the 50s, again, there's an effort to try and stop it. But what Krampus does is, and of course with Perchten as well, the female version, it reaches not only into the pre-Christian past, but it is very rough. It's very, we want to say, violent. But it's also an expression of nature. It's something that we have forgotten. As I said, we tend to forget the reason for the season and what is the real lesson going on here. The lesson is that actions have consequences. It's not just being good or bad, were you a good boy or a good girl or a bad girl. It's a matter of the invisible is present and you can't get away with anything. There's always going to be consequences. Actions have cause and effect, karma, that notion of karma. And while the word didn't exist, the notion of karma did exist within the Germanic peoples. And we see that in the idea of the word weird or fate, as we think of fate, something weird. Well, these were the three sisters, the weird sisters, who weaved the fates of human beings and gods. But this was not fatalism. This was not predetermined. This was something that you were involved with through your actions. So there is this notion of relationship of each of us being in some way the master of our destiny or having some control over it.
So you would not be surprised then that this revival, as we are all being chained to screens and various digital technologies, that there might be a revival of something that connects us to the world of nature or the earthiness from which we spring.
Not in the least. And I think it's because we are so fortunate. I mean, we are so blessed that we really don't even have to think about where our food comes from. And we've heard that so many times, but it's just the reality. We don't have to think about, do we have enough firewood or peat to get through the winter? We don't have to worry about, for the most part, who's knocking on our door at night. Even the way our houses are built, they're not built as fortifications. I mean, all the glass and all the windows, I mean, they're meant to be open and pleasant and welcoming. So we know, though, when you leave, we'll call the word civilization, things are different. And if we don't know it, we find out pretty quick. The world out there is, it can be very violent. And I don't mean in terms of humans, but just in terms of the physical world itself. You know, nature is red in tooth and claw. And this kind of reminds us a little bit about that. But I also think it's connected to, and this is for better or worse, it is in some ways connected to the changing nature of Christianity in the United States and Europe. That is also the lessening of attendance and doctrinal adherence in many ways. And it is connected to, in some ways, the pagan revival that we see going on, which has always been happening. It's always been going on for the last 30 or 40 years to varying degrees of strength or weakness. But I see it because of the distinct nature of Krampus. It is clearly connected to that. Anyone who's involved knows it. Even in Europe, they knew that this was a survival of these ancient beliefs on some level. So what we're seeing is the need to reach down deep into the psyche and get behind the, kind of the more saccharine or sanitized aspects of religious worship.
You use the word archetype in the general sense, but is this something that a Jungian perspective would say everything is poles, positive and negative poles, to balance in our psyches?
Well, I think very much, particularly when we have them combined. When we have St. Nicholas combined with Krampus, it's very clear. Now, when we combine the two, the character becomes very mercurial. But even so, that's still fitting within more classical views of deities and worship, and even Odin himself. Odin was very, mercurial. We see his shape-shifting. Zeus was very much a shape-shifting kind of fellow. And that's kind of the hidden symbolism of both Krampus and Perchten, where they have, one foot is human, or the other one foot is animal-like. It's pointing at this peculiar natural nature, the shape-shifting ability that makes them dangerous. They're in this world, but they're not of it. But that's the nature of spirituality. Isn't that the nature of the Christmas story? Jesus is in this world, but not of it. The purpose of Christmas is not to get more stuff. It's that the world has become such a dark place that God descends, according to the Christian story, God decides to send down himself to incarnate to save the world. And we see this story mentioned often, even in Hinduism and in Buddhism with their notion of avatars, that things get so bad that someone's got to step in to try and right it. And they don't fix it. That's a mistake. They don't fix it, because if they were done, everything would be okay. We wouldn't be having this conversation. What they do is they just tip the scales enough so that we as human beings can, have some kind of maybe level playing field to try and make decisions with again. So, really, when we look at Krampus and we look at this notion, it is bringing out in many ways through this demonic force, because they identify with the devil, of course, within early days. And I think it's not that. It's that I think of it more in terms of more Central Asian ideas, because there's a connection between Central Asian and Germanic or old Germanic beliefs. I think of it more in terms of what we think of a wrathful force. Because even these guys who would dress up as Krampus or Perchten, even though they're wrathful and demonic looking, their purpose was to scare away evil. So you remember, that's the evil face showing itself to you. This is a result of your actions. You have nothing to fear from Krampus if you haven't done anything wrong. And that lesson is often missed. So I think that it really is a way to dig deep into what is the real potency of how do we see light and illumination and what is the real meaning of the Christmas spirit in the midst of this world that we're in.
Mark Stavish, author of over a dozen books, who has appeared on the History Channel and A&E as an expert on Western spiritual traditions and comparative religions. He is director of studies for the Institute for Hermetic Studies, and he spoke with us today about the modern comeback of the Krampus, K-R-A-M-P-U-S.